Guardian Unlimited.
The Second Fest Festival and Second Life, produced by The Guardian and Intel. See the Pet Shop Boys, Groove Armada, and many more acts live. Go to guardian.co.uk/secondfest to find out more.
Hello, this is News Desk. My name's John Dennis. It's Thursday, June the 28th. As Tony Blair rides off into the sunset, or more accurately, Sedgefield, County Durham, where he's standing down as an MP, and the Middle East, where he's going to be an international peace envoy, today is Gordon Brown's first day as Prime Minister, and he's revealing who's going to be in his government of all the talents. Also, it's the 10th anniversary this weekend of another handover of power. Hong Kong's last British governor, Chris Patten, tells us how he's welcomed these days in China. And the Libyan man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing is expected to be granted a second appeal today against his conviction. Completing our podcast of all the talents, John Henley's got the diary and Ros Taylor's reviewing today's papers. Tony Blair got a standing ovation from MPs on all sides yesterday in his last Prime Minister's questions. But despite the goodwill towards him, he couldn't quite escape from the issue that ultimately forced him from office, Iraq.
I've never come across people of such sustained dedication, courage and commitment. I am truly sorry about the dangers that they face today in Iraq and Afghanistan. I know some may think that they face these dangers in vain. I don't, and I never will. I believe they are fighting for the security of this country and the wider world against people who would destroy our way of life. But whatever view people take of my decisions, I think there is only one view to take of them. They are the bravest and the best. Yeah. Before listing my engagements, also, can I thank you, Mr. Speaker, since it's the last time I'll be able to do so, for your gentle courtesy and kind forbearance to me over the years. I've had need of both. And now to my engagements. This morning I had meetings of ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in the House, I will have no such further meetings today or any other day.
Well, the Guardian's Oliver Berkman was at Westminster to observe yesterday's proceedings, and you'll be able to read Oliver's feature in Saturday's Guardian. I asked him if there was much affection for Tony Blair in his last Commons appearance as Prime Minister.
I actually think there was an enormous amount. There were one or two people who tried to challenge that overwhelming tone with their questions getting a bit spikier, and it didn't really work. Everyone was very much on a sort of warmth. I think the word that was used the most frequently, apart from and there was courtesy. And then in the end, he got a standing ovation, not only from the Labour benches and a fair amount of the Conservative and Lib Dem benches, but also from the entire public gallery.
Oliver Berkman. Well, I asked the Guardian columnist Martin Kettle how he thought Tony Blair would be feeling as he leaves office.
I think Tony Blair is moving on almost immediately. It's probably rather good from his own personal psychological point of view at a moment of such trauma as this that he seems to be fully engaged on his plans in the Middle East, where he is expecting to be appointed as the representative of the quartet in the Middle East. That, as everybody knows, is a vast, huge job, which makes Northern Ireland look rather straightforward. People who've talked to him say that he's already immersed in the detail of that, and that's what he's thinking about even this afternoon.
Gordon Brown made much of the use of the words change in his speech. What do you make of that?
It seemed to crop up in almost every sentence and clause. Change for this, change for that, change in the other. Clearly, this is Brown signalling that this is a different government. He's going to do things differently. He said he was going to move beyond the old politics. He's definitely got to make it clear that this is, as he sees it, a new chapter, whilst at the same time conveying to people that it is part of the same book.
Martin Kettle. The first public words of Britain's 52nd Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, were downbeat and contrasted with the glitz and the raised expectations of Tony Blair back in May 1997.
And at all times, I will be strong in purpose, steadfast in will, resolute in action, in the service of what matters to the British people, meeting the concerns and aspirations of our whole country.
Today, Gordon Brown confirms who's doing what in his government. Our political commentator, Michael White, is in Westminster. He told me, first of all, who was leaving the government.
Well, we know some names for certain. Patricia Hewitt sent out a note last night saying she'd written to Gordon, saying for personal reasons, family reasons, she wanted to step down. Now, that's a classic case of did she jump before she was pushed, or does she have genuine reasons for doing so? She's first elected in 1997, but she's been in politics for 20 years. She was Neil Kinnock's press secretary a long time ago, been in the cabinet since 2001, trade and industry, then health. It's all quite tough. She might be sensible and want a breather, unlike Tony Blair, who's just gone from one dreadful job to another. So you take it at face value. And the same is true of Baroness Amos, the leader of the Lords, first black woman in the British cabinet, who told me last night that she'd been there long enough, and when Gordon Brown had offered her the new job of EU Special Representative to Africa, they've always got a guilty conscience about Africa, then she's delighted to do it.
Who is Gordon Brown expected to appoint to succeed himself as Chancellor?
Oh, that one is pretty certain. The bookies closed their book on Alistair Darling in mid-afternoon yesterday. They'd just been flooded with money. He's been on odds-on favourite for a while. He appeared on the Today programme this morning in the 8:10 spot, which I think is as good a hint as you can get. They wouldn't have put him up if he wasn't going to be the man.
And David Miliband, a rising star in the Labour Party, which job's he going to get?
It's looking like the Foreign Office. You can never be certain of this. When I mentioned Hewitt and Amos a moment ago, I should have mentioned Margaret Beckett, great survivor. She first became a minister in this building in 1976 when Jim Callaghan was Prime Minister, and she's still there. She's had a jolly good run for her money. She didn't expect to be Foreign Secretary in the last reshuffle. She's not been distinguished. She's a shrewd, tough negotiator, Mrs. Beckett, but she hasn't distinguished herself, so it's probably her last job.
Jack Straw masterminded Brown's campaign. What's he going to do in the government?
Well, I expect Gordon Brown masterminded it, really, but Jack was pretty shrewd, as he always is. We think he's going to be Minister of Justice, in other words, one half of the Home Office. Remember, John Reid split it up, and the focus of the Home Office will be on sort of crime and counter-terrorism and security in a broad sense. And that's the big mystery, John. Nobody knows, and I ring around, I've done this for many years, the night before the reshuffle, and says, who gets what? And none of us can work out who's going to be Home Secretary. We think Alan Johnson, I'm just seeing his picture on the TV, is going to be Health Secretary to, you know, be emollient and get the health service unions and staff back on side. They're a bit fed up with all these reshuffles and reshuffles of the health service, I mean. We think that's likely to happen, but nothing certain until, lunchtime, roughly.
And there's talk that Gordon Brown might split up the Department for Education and Skills and also change around the DTI.
Well, the DTI has been floated for many years. In Britain, the government used to have a much more interventionist role, and Mrs. Thatcher, after 1979, whittled that down. We used to have what was called tripartite government involving the unions and the CBI. Corporatist is what free marketeers call it. So the DTI is being whittled down. What we expect is probably that energy will go to the Environment Department. That might be changed a little too. Changing functions is always a bit risky in Whitehall, because it does take up a lot of energy and doesn't always deliver better results. Anyway, DTI to break up, and I think it seems certain now that education will divide between higher education and skills and children. Don't forget, Gordon Brown has often said children are his priority. He grew up in a poor town, Kirkcaldy. It was once a rich industrial town, collapsing industries when he was a boy in Scotland in Fife, and I think it left a big mark on him. He knew he did pretty well. He was a very clever boy, but he watched in a sensitive way many of his classmates struggling, and that's very near to the centre of his mind and centre of his concern.
Who might enter Mr Brown's government from outside the Labour Party?
Oh, no, that's the $64,000 there, I'm afraid, John. Your budget won't run to it. There's a persistent rumour that there's a big Tory defector coming up. The Guardian suggested this morning in a very cautious way, maybe Chris Patten, Malcolm Rifkin. I have to say I disagree with my colleagues there. They are both Tories who will die Tories. I'm pretty confident of that. Hold me to it, John, if I'm wrong.
Many thanks, Mike. Now, Ros Taylor's here with today's papers. And, Ros, the papers had some difficulty, really, in covering yesterday's events, because they were so widely trailed in advance.
Well, yes, this handover has been planned for so long that it really is hard to come up with a headline that that really conveys the scale of the change yesterday. And the Telegraph goes for a quote from Mr Brown's short speech outside Number 10 yesterday. "I have heard the need for change. Now let the work of change begin." The Times goes for just the new tenants above a picture of Gordon Brown and his wife, Sarah. The word tenant, of course, implies that he's not necessarily going to be staying there for that long. Who knows? But in general, there's a real struggle, I think, on the front pages to sum up the size of this change.
The papers seem to have warm words for Gordon Brown's wife, Sarah.
Yes, of course, they didn't generally have many warm words for Cherie Blair, who left Number 10 yesterday and made quite a curt comment to the waiting press saying, bye, I don't think we'll miss you. You can imagine how that went down in Fleet Street.
Better than feral beasts, I suppose.
Quentin Letts in the Mail says, believe me, dearie, the feeling is mutual. And the Mirror says that it was a small, petty and venomous quote, but on the other hand, it did remind everyone just how much things have changed since 1997 and how much we need stuff to move on. But it was Sarah Brown who gets a really fantastic press in a lot of papers today. The Mail in particular is very keen on her, points out that she had no feminist hand-wringing qualms about the decision to change her name when she married Gordon. And a lot of the papers say just how much Gordon has relied on her to help reshape his image, not just encouraging him to get his teeth done and water down his Scottish accent a bit, but she also passes notes to him over dinner, apparently urging him to talk to the people sitting next to him. Little things like that that have helped him shake off some of the accusations of being rather antisocial.
Now, looking at Tony Blair's future, is there much optimism for his chances in securing some sort of peace in the Middle East?
I think none whatsoever in general. The optimism is decidedly absent. I can't think of anyone who could... not even Bill Clinton, who could go over there and people would say, yes, he's going to sort out the Middle East. And certainly they're not saying that about Tony Blair. The Times says one of the first things that he'll probably tackle when he moves into his offices in Jerusalem and probably the West Bank will be the system of checkpoints that Israel sets up that make it difficult for Palestinians to move between different communities on the West Bank and generally make their lives a lot harder. So that will be one of the first things he wants to tackle. But the Herald Tribune has gone to the West Bank to try and to see how much presence Hamas has there. Now, of course, Hamas basically took over the Gaza Strip this month, kicked out the Palestinian Prime Minister and kicked out Fatah, the ruling party. And the Herald Tribune says that it also has a very powerful presence in the West Bank. It's just lying low.
Now, if anyone's been to Rome on holiday, I went there last year, and they'll have seen outside the Colosseum someone dressed as a centurion, usually several people actually, dressed as Roman centurions. Why are they in the paper, Ros?
One of them has turned a bit nasty. there's a story in the Times today about one of these centurions who came up to a couple visiting from LA. Turns out the man is a wine-loving, wealthy businessman, but despite being wealthy, he was not particularly generous. After posing for photographs with the centurion, he offered him a whopping €4, which, as you'll know, is about £2.70. Centurions generally are after about 20 or 30 euros, and at least, and this didn't go down very well. So the guy came up with a $2 bill. The centurion offered to use it as a handkerchief. And then, in the words of the unfortunate businessman, he became vulgar and aggressive and started insulting us, then pushing and pulling us. We moved away thinking that was the end of it. Instead, he came at us and started attacking us savagely with kicks and punches, screaming and shouting. No one came to our aid. So it was all a bit gladiatorial, really.
Many thanks, Ros.
And that is that. The end.
And don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap. That's our daily email service, guardian.co.uk/wrap. On December the 21st, 1988, 270 people died when Pan Am Flight 103 was blown up over Lockerbie in Scotland. In 2001, the former Libyan intelligence officer Abdel Basset Ali Mohamed Al-Megrahi was convicted of their murder. Today, the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission is expected to refer the case to the Court of Appeal. Professor Robert Black, who devised the trial of Al-Megrahi at Camp Zeist in the Netherlands, told Severin Carroll, the Guardian's Scotland correspondent, why he believes Al-Megrahi is innocent.
I think there were faults in the original trial, which involved both the prosecution in what they did and indeed did not do at the time of the trial. I think there were also faults in the conduct of the defence of Mr. Megrahi at the original trial. But most important of all, I think, that notwithstanding the faults on the part of the prosecution and the defence, the miscarriage of justice would not have occurred unless the judges had reached a decision which, in my view, was entirely contrary to the weight of the evidence and which no reasonable tribunal on the evidence led should have reached.
What do you think was the core weakness at the heart of the conviction of El Megrahi? What is it, do you think, that gives the greatest cause for concern for jurists and for observers?
I think it was the failure of the trial court properly to weigh in the balance evidence that ran counter to the prosecution's case.
Mm-hmm.
There was evidence that cast very great doubt on the scenario that the prosecution put forward and in respect of which they led evidence. That counter-evidence, that evidence which supported the accused and his plea of not guilty, was, in my view, blithely and wrongly ignored by the trial judges.
Do you think that Mr. Megrahi is indeed the subject of a miscarriage?
I have absolutely no doubt of that.
That's Professor Robert Black. Now, John Henley's here with the Guardian Diary. And, John, I understand the Guardian Diary's got evidence that a new day has dawned.
Well, it would indeed seem so, John, today. Yes, we're pleased to see that one of the very first press releases to come out of Number 10 yesterday evening was the Prime Minister has welcomed the news that Tony Blair has been appointed a Middle East envoy. Just that doesn't sound quite right, does it? The Prime Minister has welcomed the new day. Certainly dawned. Meanwhile, in a parallel universe, we're indebted to Delafont Music for the news that, and we quote, with material that keeps his audiences laughing and an act that manages to get a standing ovation time after time, comedian and singing impressionist Gordy Brown seems to have it all going for him. Gordy Brown continues to perform on stage more than 100 shows a year for such major corporations as Ford, AT&T, PepsiCo and Motorola. Gordy Brown may even be available for your next special event. Let's hope he finds time in that packed schedule for us. We'll be moving swiftly on thanks to the next to the far more important news that our new essential new product of the month award will be going to the Kohler C3 toilet seat with remote control, a mere $1,300. In addition to two cleansing wands providing warm aerated water, it says here, the C3 toilet seat also features a heated seat with three temperature seating settings, a warm air fan for partial drying, a lighted bowl that eliminates the need to turn on a light at night, a deodorizer that minimizes unpleasant odors, a quiet close seat cover that prevents slamming, a quick release hinges to easily remove the seat for cleaning, and just like the seating, driving, heating controls in a luxury automobile, you can even have personal settings adjustable by remote control. A snip at $1,300, I think you'll agree. The Sunday Mail of Scotland next has the interesting story of a Scottish man charged with having simulated sex with a bicycle. This is Mr. Robert Stewart from Ayr, allegedly naked from the waist down in a hotel room when two cleaners walked in. They say they were shocked to find him mock copulating with a bicycle and that he continued to do so as they looked on. He's been charged with conducting himself in a disorderly manner. His client, Jerry Tierney, said, "My client denies the allegations and intends to defend the charge vigorously. We expect no less." And Mr. Stewart himself says that the incident was all a misunderstanding, partly due to the fact that he had had too much to drink. Surely not. And finally, John, we are sent a mail from yet another alert listener who tells us that my good friend Dave worked for many years at Crewsaver Life Jackets in Gosport, Hampshire, who had a sales rep rejoicing in the name Will Drown.
Many thanks, John. Don't forget to send John your tips to diary@guardian.co.uk. This Sunday, it'll be 10 years since Britain handed control of Hong Kong back to China. Britain's last governor was Chris Patten, affectionately known in Hong Kong as Fat Pang. The Guardian Unlimited's Peter Walker asked him what he thought when he saw the emotional pictures of himself leaving Hong Kong back in 1997.
I'd never seen any of those moments before, leaving Government House, the drenching rain, the speech in the rain, leaving in Britannia and all the rest, and watching it for the first time. Well, it brought back memories 10 years ago, but it was also, even at this distance, a bit emotional.
am the 28th governor, the last governor. Like all the other governors and their families, my wife, my children and myself will take Hong Kong home in our hearts. It has been the greatest honour and privilege of my life to share your home for 5 years and to have some responsibility for your future.
Do you feel disappointed at all with the lack of democratic progress in Hong Kong? Since then, you said that China has dragged its feet.
It's fair to say that Jiang Zemin talked about democratic development in Hong Kong in line with local conditions in his speech at the handover. Well, the interpretation which seems to have been made since then on local conditions is they don't allow any democratic development at all. Hong Kong is in that sense less democratic now than it was when I left. But Hong Kong remains a free, plural society with all the institutions and attributes of an open society, with the single exception that it can't elect its own government, which is pretty absurd, and doesn't have an agreed process of getting to a situation where it can elect its own government. That said, apart from that and a couple of interventions, unwise interventions by the Chinese leadership in decisions made by the Hong Kong courts, the Chinese leadership have by and large been on their best behaviour in relation to Hong Kong, which I welcome, and Hong Kong has not ceased to be a free society under the rule of law. I think partly thanks to the growing sense of citizenship which began to manifest itself in the 80s and 90s. You have today 600,000-700,000 people who are prepared to turn out on the streets in Hong Kong to defend their civil liberties, to assert their democratic claims. And I think that is a wonderful sign of political vitality in Hong Kong.
At the time, there were a lot of choice insults thrown your way, like tango dancer. Do you have a favourite insult which you still cherish, or do they actually, in fact, still hurt now?
Tango dancer was quite interesting because I'd said once when I was asked if I was prepared to negotiate something with China, I can't remember what it was now, and I said, well, it takes two to tango. So that became, through the artifice of Chinese propaganda, tango dancer as a term of abuse. I think I was probably the last target of that sort of invective as part of diplomacy, which used to feature more prominently in Chinese diplomatic engagements, no longer does so. And it never had much of an impact on me, as I used to say to people at the time. I'd been the minister who didn't invent the poll tax, the wretched bloody thing, but had the responsibility for implementing the poll tax. And having been through that, nothing the Chinese could say about me was likely to meet what people had, in some respects, legitimately said about me when I was the Secretary of State for the Environment. And the Chinese are much more sophisticated today, and in general, than some of their mindless supporters. Indeed, I suspect that because of my record on democracy in China and human rights in China, it quite helps them to have somebody who argues, as I do, that China isn't a threat to the rest of the world and that the next century should not be regarded as a sort of hegemonic struggle between China and the United States. I mean, we need that like a hole in the head.
Chris Patton. Today's edition of News Desk,
and that is that, the end,
was produced by Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
The Second Fest Festival and Second Life, produced by The Guardian and Intel. See the Pet Shop Boys, Groove Armada, and many more acts live. Go to guardian.co.uk/secondfest to find out more.
Guardian Unlimited.